Well, happy Easter and Ohayou gozaimasu for our Japanese friends who are celebrating the flower festival of Hanamatsuri, commemorating the Buddha's birthday. This is the season of sakura, cherry blossoms. Sakura are the most beloved flowers in Japan because they have a very short blooming season and are quite fragile. They symbolize the transience of life, a central teaching of Buddhism. And since the islands of Japan extend over several thousand miles and span several climate zones, sakura festivals also follow the sun northward, beginning in February in far southern regions such as Okinawa and ending in June in Hokkaido, way up north. Japanese TV stations and online weather reports give updated cherry blossom forecasts, much like the fall foliage forecasts here in Michigan. Now, we Unitarian Universalists are a curious lot when Easter rolls around. Some of us are cynical toward the myths and symbols that form the core of Christian tradition and practice. Some are unable to find any deeply satisfying and relevant meaning to Easter. This confusion does pose a challenge for those of us who have bothered to fix ourselves up and make our way into an Easter service. It's as if we are all dressed up, but do we have anywhere theologically to go? I, for one, am something of an egomaniac on Easter. Yes, ego. Never mind the cholesterol. Consider the egg. It's a miracle. A thing so diverse for its size that we hardly can help growing lyrical when given the pullet surprise. The scope of this peerless comestible must drive other foods to despair, since it's not only fully digestible, but great for shampooing the hair. It's boilable, poachable, friable. It scrambles. It makes a sauce thicken. It's also the only reliable device for producing a chicken. Maybe that's enough of an Easter message, huh? Easter is colored eggs and bunnies. According to legend, we have Easter bunnies thanks to Estra, the ancient Anglo-Saxon goddess of spring. Long ago, Estra saved a bird whose wings had frozen solid during the previous winter. She did this by changing the frozen bird into a bunny rabbit, a rabbit that could lay multicolored eggs. Now, how's that for believing what ain't so? Question, when you were a child, was believing what ain't so part of Easter? We UU ministers, amidst our own ambivalence about Easter, may serve up a thin, weak broth full of cliches, but without much nutritional value. My colleague Forrester Church once remarked that a suitable Easter sermon title for us UU ministers unsure what to do might be Upsy Daisy, and I borrowed from his suggestion. For me, my friends, Easter as a seasonal celebration, of course, is necessary. And yet that alone, for me, is just not quite sufficient. Eastering, for me, is much more of a verb rather than a noun. Easter represents a radical movement of the human heart. It means decisively getting up and walking away from places of stagnation and cynicism and deadness and fear. It is deciding how to live before we die, not speculating about what might happen afterwards. And it's certainly not about resuscitating corpses. It's not a whodunit about what happened to the body. Easter is how you and I choose to live right now. It's about rolling away those stones that have imprisoned you and me in tombs of deadness and cynicism and despair and other limitations, self-imposed and otherwise. And that's what our conversations are about today. In the words of Auden, with which we began, the inevitable is what will seem to happen to you purely by chance. And the real is what will strike you as really absurd. Well, we are welcoming back the sun, not only here, but also in Norway, which we heard about a few minutes ago. There is one village in Norway whose name I cannot pronounce, which has constructed three reflecting mirrors on the mountaintop to the north of the valley, and these mirrors reflect the sunlight down into the village. I would like to make a journey there at some point and see how this is done. This is also the season of welcoming back the sun in my own way. You have noticed that I have transformed my winter device into a five wood. I must admit I have not swung this baby yet to even see if I have the movement in my left arm to do so. But this is part of my welcoming back, son. And if Alan Hunt and others of our golf fanatics and, of course, Bill Goodman might want to join me out on the links, we can welcome back the son in our own way. Here is another. Well, let me do a short reading first, and then I'm going to have another little astronomical update. Reading is by Edna St. Vincent Millay. Surely one of the most compelling poets of the 20th century. She writes, "I am not resigned to the shutting away of loving hearts in the hard ground. So it is, and so it will be, for so it has been time out of mind. Into the darkness they go, the wise and the lovely, crowned with lilies and with laurel they go. But I am not resigned. The answer's quick and keen, the honest look, the laughter, the love, they are gone. Gone to feed the roses. Elegant and curled is the blossom, fragrant is the blossom, I know, but I do not approve. More precious was the light in your eyes than all the roses in the world. Gently they go, the beautiful, the tender, the kind. Quietly they go, the intelligent, the witty, the brave. I know, but I do not approve. And I am not resigned." It was just before sunset. Lookouts stood watch on the mountains east of Jerusalem, and they were looking for the first light of the full moon, rising over the mountains of Moab beyond the Dead Sea Rift Valley. A gentle westerly breeze from the Mediterranean brought a chill to the desert air. The city, crowded with 60,000 pilgrims, bustled in anticipation as darkness arrived to mark the beginning of Passover. It had been a mostly normal day in Judea, an eastern province of the Roman Empire. That afternoon, the Romans executed a Jewish hillbilly from Galilee under charges of sedition. But while that created something of a stir, that unpleasantness was past. The body of the executed man, as required by Jewish law, was buried, according to some accounts, in a borrowed tomb outside the western wall. But that was long ago. Now sunset approached, Passover approached. The pilgrims eagerly awaited the signal from the lookouts, sighting the full moon. And yet the moon's rising at 6:20 p.m. that evening was not quite normal. The lookouts beheld not a brightly glowing moon, but a moon of dark reddish brown in total lunar eclipse. The crowds in the city below scarcely noticed this eclipse. Did any of you see the eclipse early Saturday morning? I'm not sure it was even visible here. The lookouts on Mount Scopus, they noticed that lunar eclipse. Because, see, this was a pre-Copernican world, long before Copernicus and Galileo. And Pontius Pilate, he noticed. In fact, he wrote a long letter to his boss, the Emperor Tiberius, back in Rome. And Pontius Pilate's letter, which we do have, he described all the troublesome events of that day, including the execution of the Galilean hillbilly. And he also wrote in his letter to his boss that on that night, the moon appeared like blood. The date was Friday, April 3rd in the year 33 CE. Of that much, we can be fairly sure. After all, lunar and solar eclipses can be projected both in hindsight and ahead with incredible accuracy. We can be fairly sure of that date. But what happened next? In particular, what happened 2 days later on Sunday, April 5th in the year of 33 CE? Well, the oldest of the Gospels, Mark, reports this. Very early on the first day of the week, they got to the tomb just as the sun was coming up. They had been asking themselves, who will help us roll the stone away from the opening of the tomb? Then they looked up and discovered that the stone had been rolled away. My title today is ambiguous. What's this about rolling stones? Those of us of a certain generation might remember that just over 40 years ago, a commercial artist and part-time drummer named Charlie Watts got up and he walked away from his tomb. He left his humdrum day job in London, and he rounded out the lineup of an unknown musical group called the Rolling Stones. Nowadays, members of that legendary rock group, including lead singer Mick Jagger and guitarist Keith Richards, they're in their early 70s. Yep. Mick is just a month or two older than yours truly. He's a grandfather. And what wisdom does this number one stone, still on tour as a grandpa, what wisdom might he have to offer? Either you're dead or you move along. Not bad. I wonder if any such words might have echoed through Jerusalem 20 centuries ago in the year 33 CE, after the lunar eclipse, after the moon turned to blood, outside that mythical empty tomb, which was once covered by a rolling stone. Hey, either you're dead or you move along. That's not in the New Testament. It might as well have been. Once upon a time, there was a circus bear. This little bear traveled with the circus from one town to the next through small towns in Central Europe. The bear's home, year after year, was a wagon cage. And this cage measured 9 feet by 9 feet. A terribly cramped space for an animal as large and as lumbering as a bear. This circus bear endured all sorts of abusive treatment. His owners were indifferent to giving him proper food, water, grooming, medical attention, and exercise, and so forth. Circus goers would often poke and prod at the bear through the bars of the cage. And as a result, the little bear became mangy and bedraggled. He was jostled mercilessly as his small cage bounced along the rutted roads of Central Europe, traveling from one small town to the next. Inside his tiny cage, this little bear remained vulnerable to the cruel extremes of the elements. And then late one summer, something unexpected happened. The little circus failed, and as a result, many of the circus animals, including the mangy, flea-bitten little bear, were taken to the Berlin Zoo. And there, this little bear was finally set free. The doors of his cage were flung open, and the bear found himself in the midst of a large, luxuriously landscaped area where he was free to wander. There was flowing water, bathing pools, trees, ledges, lairs, and best of all, there were other bears nearby to play with. It was a kind and humane home for any bear. And yet, even though this circus bear was finally free of his confinement and able to roam freely within a vast and enticing new home, nevertheless, day in and day out, the bedraggled little bear paced back and forth within a 9-foot by 9-foot square for the rest of the bear's life. It continued to enslave itself in an imaginary space, even though the physical barriers to which it had grown accustomed were no longer there. The bear never learned how to be free. Free of its previous confinement and free to frolic with the other bears nearby. Friends, you and I dwell in our own world of 9-by-9 cages, real and imagined, perhaps out of time-worn habits, addictions, compulsions. We pace around within our 9-by-9 worlds of confinement and self-imposed limitations, places which at least are familiar, and thus we may cling to them in some sense of comfort. And yet there are many other 9-by-9 cages in our world that are all too real. For many folks, their life is degrading. For others, their own homes have become a prison of meanness, exploitation, starvation, brutality. You know, in a sense, we live in a Good Friday world, a world of undeniable and inescapable pain and suffering. In every nation, in every age, there are those whose only identity seems to be to crush others and to crucify anyone who dares to offer a way of compassion and love. In the midst of these harsh realities, what can one possibly say about Easter in a Good Friday world? The feminist theologian Carter Hayward puts the Easter myth in focus and in terms that I think go to the heart of the matter. The accounts in the Christian Bible, accounts of resurrection, these are not about resuscitation of a corpse. These are not about what happened to a particular dead body. That's irrelevant. Easter is about what happened to the closest friends of the one who died. What happened to them? Let me tell you a secret. If you read elsewhere in the New Testament, you'll notice something funny. And that is that Yeshua's presence was felt only by those who loved him, not by the Romans, not by a representative cross-section of the populace, only by those who loved him. Rather stunning. No, that's not a fact of a physical resuscitation of a corpse. It's about a kind of what? Soul sketching. This is what we do so marvelously here at our memorials at People's Church. These memorials are not factual biographies which might appear in a resume. These are soul sketches. And that's what we should read these bizarre accounts in the New Testament as. These are not biography. These are soul sketches. You see, love becomes a transforming force in this world only when it becomes embodied. Embodied in people whom we can name and touch and who can carry on that which endures, that which goes beyond the death of the body, that which says, I am not resigned. So Easter is not a forensic detective story. It's a powerful statement about where love resides and where love becomes most powerful. Not in hypothetical speculations about what might be next or somewhere else. Love emerges in the embodied experiences which we experience and with which we struggle and which engage us. Not later on, right here, this is it. Easter is not about where did the body go. It is an affirmation. Then we met someone who shared his bread with us, who showed us the new water here in the city of our hope. He who brought water is with us. He who brought bread is with us. The point is this. Easter is not predictable or even plausible from anything that has gone before. And that's why, to me at least, and I must emphasize, this is to me, I don't presume it applies to anybody else. To me, Easter is seasonal celebrations plus. And here's the plus for me. The plus is that Eastering has to be a little more than here we go again. It has to be a radical decision of the human heart to get up and walk away from my own 9x9 cages. And, if possible, from those that maybe I have constructed around others. And so the central question for today is your tomb empty? I must admit, some of the time my tomb isn't empty. In fact, I sometimes stock it with provisions. I enjoy lingering in my little tombs. I fix them up to be comfortable, and I host pity parties in my little tombs. These are where I go when I am afraid to risk the pain and foolishness and joys of my life. My tomb is where I protect myself, where I rely on routine, habit, and approval from others. You ever been there? My tomb is where I escape from pain and joy, where I can shrug, pout, make excuses, say, I told you so. I don't sleep in my tomb. I lie awake there, and I plot strategy in my little tombs. My little slogans of resignation, I rehearse them in my little tombs. What are you going to do? There they go again. What can you expect from someone like that? You know the slogans. Those are tomb slogans. I feel cozy in my little tombs. Safe from failure, I wrap my body and soul in a kind of antiseptic shroud, and I am very safe. So the question for us today, friends, is where do you and I dwell in paralysis? Have we put our hearts, minds, and souls on ice? And how shall we roll away those stones of isolation and despair and cynicism and instead breathe once again the wonder and the risk of being more fully alive? So here's today's take-home question. Often I try to give you a take-home question or quiz. Here's today's. What resurrections have you plotted against the odds, against reasonableness, despite those carping voices from within and from without? You know those voices who say, it'll never work. Somebody tried that before. We've never done it that way before. It might offend somebody. You know those voices. So the important question is, where shall we dwell? Not after we die, but before we die. Have you had a pre-death experience? Not near death, pre. Will we dwell in tombs of safety, in 9x9 cages of predictable stagnation, to avoid the possibility of hurt and loss? Or will we come out of our tombs and risk life before death? Maybe have a near-life experience. In Herman Melville's novel, Moby Dick, the mate on the whaling vessel is Mr. Starbuck. And Starbuck is out in the harpoon boat away from the Pequod, the mothership. As a storm comes up, the small boat encounters a whale, which swamps the boat and all of the occupants of the small boat. And here's what happens. This is from Moby Dick. There we sat, up to our knees in the sea, the water covering every rib and plank of the boat. The wind increased to a howl. The waves dashed their bucklers together. In vain we hailed the other small boats. The rising sea forbade all attempts to bail out our boat. The oars were useless as propellers, performing now the role of life preservers. Finally, cutting the lashing of the waterproof match keg, Mr. Starbuck, after many failures, contrived to light the lamp in the lantern. And then, stretching it out on a waif pole, he handed the lamp to Queequeg, who became the standard bearer of our forlorn hope. And there he sat, holding up this imbecile candle in the heart of that almighty forlornness. There then he sat, the sign and the symbol of a man without faith, hopelessly holding up hope in the middle of despair. Hopelessly holding up hope. I think that's maybe one of our missions at People's Church, is standing on the gates of hope. People of hope, of course. Holding up an imbecile candle into the raging teeth of the world's forlornness. And that's what Eastering is. That's what it takes for any human being to get up and walk away from their tombs of despair. So Easter, friends, to me, is not supernaturalism, it's not magic, it's not anti-science, and it's not later on. It's right now. In resurrection, two things happen. You lose yourself, and you find that you are more fully yourself than usual. And that sounds like strange arithmetic. Let me explain. It's kind of like love. When you really love somebody, no longer are you at the center of the universe. It's a different geometry when you really love somebody. No longer are you the gravitational center of your universe. You forget yourself. You give of yourself so that by all the rules of arithmetical logic, if you give of yourself, there should be less of you. However, by a curious paradox, there is more. You feel that at last you really are more fully yourself. The Sufi poet Jalal ad-Din Rumi wrote, "The breezes at dawn have secrets to tell you." At dawn. At dawn, not just on Easter, but every other day. "The breezes at dawn have secrets to tell you. People are going back and forth across the door. Across the door sill where the two worlds touch. The door is round and open. The stone has been rolled away. Don't go back to sleep," says Rumi. "Don't go back to sleep. The doorways are open. The stone has been rolled away. Don't go back to sleep. The empty tomb never happened. The empty tomb always happens." I invite you to join me in some words of our epilogue. These will be projected onto the screen. These are an extension of some words we heard from David Isaacson last week. These are the words of Kentucky poet Wendell Berry. Do we have those words? We do not have them. In that case, I'll read them. "So friends, every day do something that won't compute. Love the world. Work for nothing. Love someone who does not deserve it. Ask questions that have no answers. Plant sequoias and say that your main crop is the forest that you did not plant and that you will not live to harvest. Laugh and be joyful, even though you have considered all the facts. Practice resurrection."